Chipmunk roadie for the defense. Remember that? SCTV. Dude, you're popping your peas. Chipmunk roadie for the defense. Okay, I'm going to hope that I remember how to do this. This is a podcast. This is a podcast during the Stanley Cup playoffs where there's been a lot of excitement. There's been a lot of upsets. There's been a lot of chaos. There's been a lot of fun. There's a lot of controversial plays. So, Elliot Friedman, let's talk about Yevgeny Malkin.
Okay, sure.
In that spirit, because you write about him this week extensively on 31 Thoughts at sportsnet.ca. Listen, the Malkin to fill in the blank has been out there
a long time.
Years. It's always been, oh, they have the luxury, specifically when Jordan Staal was still part of the team. Look, Staal can pop up to the second line center hole, Crosby and Staal, you're on your way. You can turn Malkin into whatever, and the Pittsburgh Penguins can start to write their legacy in this generation.
Mm-hmm.
The rumors are back, mm-hmm. and it's more than just idle whispers, and it's more than just idle tweets, and it's more than just, you know, threads at, you know, Reddit hockey. Where's Pittsburgh at now with Malkin after the first round playoff disaster?
First of all, let me just say to every fan who's listening to this, I understand your skepticism. You know, we've been wrong about this before. There was one time a few years ago where some comments I made that I didn't mean to get blown up the way they were did, so I've been just as guilty as anybody else. There is something to this. The Penguins are contemplating some major changes. Mm-hmm. I think it's very likely that Kessel is traded regardless. I think they will field offers for Letang, although I'm not convinced that he's getting traded. I think of all the guys they could trade, Letang might be the one with the most value because he's a defenseman and he's good and he's under contract at a number at 7-something that's pretty reasonable.
7.25.
And he cares. Like,
3 more years.
Nobody debates Letang's care. Like, that is a guy, if you get him, he's going to care a ton about your team. But I also know that Rutherford loves Letang, and he's apparently told people that Letang is taking way too much blame for what happened in the first round of the playoffs. Now, Malkin, I did get a call last night from somebody who has heard the rumors, and he thinks that they are not medium makeup. He thinks they are legit. Malkin didn't have a great year. He wasn't up to Malkin standards.
Yep.
And he's wondering if Pittsburgh is trying to rattle his cage a bit. Just to say, you know, Yevgeny, last year wasn't you. We want you to be you. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a way of doing it. Malkin has a no move clause. And the word is he's at least thinking about would he agree. And so we're probably, I don't know, days to weeks away from finding out what Malkin thinks. The smartest thing is that, you know, he goes to Florida after the season. He's going to Russia for the World Championships. I think that it's good to get away and think, and I think that's exactly where we are right now. But there are teams out there, I believe, I think the Rangers are one. Wouldn't be surprised if Florida's another that are kind of waiting to find out,
Florida seems to be in on everybody.
Yes, but he's got to want to go there, right? Like, are we going to be in on this?
See, when I read your piece and I saw the two teams that you mentioned, and one was the Rangers and one was the Florida Panthers,
yep.
The other team that came to mind right away, because one, you have to look for a couple of things. One, a team that's willing to absorb that cap hit and also has a similar number to export in a player. And we all know that Jim Rutherford isn't shy about making the big move.
Nope.
He will swing for the fence. But when you're making a move like Yevgeny Malkin, you need someone else on the other side of that phone call who's willing to make the big move.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, and again, under the umbrella of he still would need to waive, but could there be a fit with Nashville?
And which player are you talking about?
Pernell, Carl Subban.
I don't think Subban has no trade protection. I don't think Nashville picked it up. All of that makes sense to me. It's possible. First of all, Malkin has to want to go.
100%.
And secondly, he's got to agree to go wherever they could do it. Put it this way. Somebody said to me that there have been a lot of rumors about Malkin over the years. Some had a little bit to them. Some were BS. He said there's something here. And this is a guy who would know.
How often do teams do this? In order to rattle the cage, get a couple of whispers out, get a note out that, you know what, maybe we're not hanging on to this guy as tightly as we once were.
It happens periodically. Jim Rutherford, he's been around for a long time.
Yep.
If he's doing this to rattle the cage, he's as smart as anybody is about the message he wants to get across and what he wants to do. If that's the plan, he's accomplished it. I had one GM once tell me that this was several years ago, mm-hmm. that he wanted to rattle a player's cage. And I said, are you serious about making the deal? He goes, no. And I said, you know, I'm not comfortable doing that.
Okay. Because that's not reporting.
Also, like, I know what we do. It can disrupt families and stuff like that. And I just said, you know, I appreciate you thinking enough of me that you would leak me this information. But if you don't mind, I'm not comfortable doing that. And he understood. He was good about it. What this person said to me was he could see Pittsburgh keeping him and hoping it works that way. Mm-hmm. But he thinks they're legitimately trying to find out, A, where Malkin would consider going to, and B, what the market is. I do think Pittsburgh feels they need to retool.
I was going to say that this speaks to two things here. One, it speaks to Malkin, the player, and two, it speaks to the Pittsburgh Penguins, the team.
Yeah.
And if you're looking or entertaining the idea of moving Evgeny Malkin, what does it say about your team knowing that Crosby's still there?
I believe there was somebody out there who said, well, if Malkin's available, is there any chance Crosby's available? And they were like, no. That's another story I got told yesterday. But Pittsburgh and Washington, which is also kind of about to go through the same thing.
Yeah, we're going to get there too.
They have both decided that as long as Sidney Crosby and Alexander Ovechkin are on the roster, they're never rebuilding. So whenever Sidney Crosby retires and whenever Alexander Ovechkin retires, if they have to go through pain, they'll go through pain. But they're never doing it while both those players are there. So this is Pittsburgh's way of saying, look, we know we're not good enough anymore. We got shown that by the Islanders. How do we get back to being good enough while we have Crosby? And the answer is you make a deal for things that can help you right now. And that's what they're looking at. They're looking at how they can figure out a way to get better through their current roster.
Could it be a situation where next season is the season of pain, where there is that small step backwards? You know, the arrow has to go backwards before it goes forwards. That for the Pittsburgh
Penguins? I don't think they want that.
At all?
I don't think they want it at all. Like, they don't want it. They don't want to do what Chicago's going through. They don't want that.
But
now,
that,
maybe,
but
that, now,
that
maybe it won't
just
work.
Just by the nature of the salary cap, though. Like, this isn't anything deliberately that Chicago has done.
Right. But their plan is to say, we're not trying to do that. We're not accepting a step back mm-hmm. to go forward. That's not what they want. Now, it may happen, but that's not what they want. And the interesting thing to me is I watched Jim Rutherford's end-of-season media conference, and everybody is picking on him saying, our defense is good enough.
I think our defense is probably the best now that it's been since I've been here as a group. You always like mobile defensemen. You like guys that can move the puck. We have at least one guy in each pairing that can move the puck. And now we got guys can have some pushback. You know, I mean, at one point in time, you ask me, do we have enough guys that can push back? And now you're asking me if I have enough guys can have speed. If you find those guys, they're making $15 million a year and there aren't any.
You should key on to that statement, but not for the reason everyone's making fun of it. Like, his defense is not. No. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, I don't think I have to make a deal with my defenseman.
I can still see Pittsburgh making a move with the blue line. Whenever I see general managers defending one area of his team, I say to myself, he is trying to beef up the stock of that area of his squad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say, wow, we need help on the blue line, and damn it, I'm going to go out and find it this summer. Because then you're negotiating from a position of weakness.
I should say, I think you're right. I think that's his way of saying that if he does deal Letang, he thinks they can handle it, depending on what they get.
There's one name that's been out there and was attached to the Penguins a couple of seasons ago, and I think Olli Maatta's name may have been joined in the trade discussion.
Uh-huh.
And you wrote about him this week, and that's what got my radar up again vis-a-vis Pittsburgh. And we'll get more to this person's team later. I wonder if Jacob Trouba ends up in Pittsburgh.
Now, I've been told that Maatta's trade value is very low.
Yeah.
I think they've tried to do that for a while, and it hasn't gone anywhere. So we'll see. But Trouba's a good one, too. Like, to me, Trouba's one of the most fascinating things. The conventional wisdom is he's gone. He's getting traded after this year.
Mm-hmm.
But as I wrote, there was one guy who said to me, if you're Winnipeg and you think you can win, do you keep him as your own rental?
We're calling it now the Columbus effect.
The Columbus effect.
I don't see why not.
I would. If I really thought I could win next year and Trouba was a part of that, I'm going for it.
We'll get more to Winnipeg in a second, but do they have to win next season?
I think now, you know what? What are we learning about this league, Jeff? If you think you can win, you got to go for it. There's no putting it off. You can't.
Final thought on Pittsburgh before we go to break. This was a disappointing way to go out.
Yeah. I think Jim Rutherford, you said it earlier, he's unafraid. You know, you take a look at the two of the oldest GMs, Poile and Rutherford, they're two of the brassiest.
Yeah. That's why I put them together right away, and I thought to myself, they're going to need
yeah,
to,
that's the kind of
they're
move.
They're going to need to make a move. You know, Nashville probably wants to make a move as well. They're going to have to pay Roman Josi in a couple of years. That's going to be an expensive ticket.
But they don't have Dante to make Fabre. A cap move next year.
No, they don't. They do have that luxury. Their cap window versus their win window is not next year.
Yeah.
It's the year after.
Yes.
And that's with Roman Josi.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. Plenty to get to. It's been a while. Thanks for joining us. This is 31 Thoughts, the podcast, brought to you by the next generation GMC Sierra Denali.
One face off. Potentially left in the Jets' season. To the left of Binnington. And it's going to be Little to take it against Ryan O'Reilly. Here we go. Pull back. Loose puck. Cleared. And the Blues are moving on. And the Jets' season comes to an end here in St. Louis.
More great calls from Dave Randorf. Not great calls if you're a Winnipeg Jets fan or a Winnipeg Jet. And now the questions become, after dovetailing with the conversation about Jacob Trouba, what are the decisions now that face Kevin Cheveldayoff? What would be Exhibit A right now for Winnipeg? First order of business is what?
Well, that's a great question. The first order of business is just to decompress and get the anger out of your head. Because I think there's a lot of anger there. They thought they would be going a lot farther than this. It ended very badly. So the first thing you've got to do is just take a deep breath and relax. I can't answer this question linearly in terms of the roster.
Mm-hmm.
The first order of business is probably to figure out what Laine's contract is going to be.
Okay? By way of number or by way of term?
Oh, well, I think one affects the other, right? I think it's going to be a bridge deal. There's a lot of momentum that's been trending towards a bridge deal. As we sit here today, Wednesday, May 1st, discussing what this contract is going to be,
mm-hmm.
I can't see the two sides agreeing on a long-term deal.
I don't think the player would want it.
Why?
Right now? This was a soft season for Patrick Laine, by his standards.
Well, I think that's why the team wouldn't want it either, because I'm not sure they want to commit. Exactly.
I don't think either side wants it.
Right. I mean, you want it if you can agree on the number. I just don't think they're going to be able to agree on the number. He had the one great game of the playoffs where they took pains to point out how good he was.
Yep.
You know what I really liked about Laine? At the end of the season, they brought up he had some injuries and stuff like that, and he's like, nothing I can't handle. I like that. You ask people around the league about Laine, you get a lot of interesting answers. Everybody recognizes his talent. He is an incredibly talented guy. We all know that. You know what the biggest criticism is of him? He just needs to do more on the ice. When he's not in the offensive zone, you don't notice him. And I said to someone, well, can you learn that? I got to think you can learn that. And they go, absolutely. If you have the will to do that, you can. Like, if I'm Winnipeg, I'm taking the bet. I'm keeping him. I haven't heard any trade rumors about him, but I wouldn't even entertain it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see this next contract, and I want to see where he goes. But I think it'll be a bridge. I still think the number will be difficult to get to. I know in the Matthews negotiations, the Leafs pitched a 3-year deal, which would have taken him 1 year away from UFA. And Matthews Camp thought about it, but then they said the number's got to be 9. Because if we're taking a 3-year deal, we're taking a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be $9 million a year. And Toronto said, no, you know, we don't want to do that for a 3-year deal.
Right.
So I still don't necessarily think that's going to be easy.
See, the way I look at it is this guy scores goals. Goals are expensive.
Yes.
And for goals, you have to pay.
Yes.
And I know that some Brian Brook a number of times on Wednesday Night Hockey has said, look, you love Patrick Laine when he's scoring, but if he's not scoring, he gives you nothing.
Well, I think that's the meaner way of what I was just saying.
As you were just saying that, I'm like, okay, if I'm Brian Burke sitting right here, I step in and say, what my client is trying to say is that if he's not scoring, he's giving you nothing.
Yes.
So you're saying even just give the appearance?
No, but I think you want, like that game in the St. Louis series where they went out of their way to praise him.
Yeah.
He had a big body, like, and he did a lot of things. Like, he got in the way, he checked. I think they just want to see more of that on a consistent basis. And the thing you have to judge is, can they do it? And who's writing this guy off at 21 years old? I'm not. Like, I assume he's going to grow into it. So, like, Winnipeg prefers to do term. They tried to do term with Morrissey. He didn't do it.
Yeah.
But they did term with Hellebuck. They did term with Ehlers. They like to do term with a lot of their guys.
Ryan Little.
Wheeler, Byfuglien, Scheifele, they do term. I have a feeling they'll agree not to do term with Laine. I think Connor, they'll try to do term, and I think he wants term. But again, I don't think that's an easy one to do. The other one I've heard is they want to try to find a way to keep Tanev.
Yeah, you wrote about that. See, I looked at that one and I said to myself, this is not unlike Washington with Jay Beagle, where you want to keep him, but you know for your salary structure, you're just not going to be able to. I don't know how they keep Brandon Tanev.
I don't know, but I think they're going to try. Like, so I look at that lineup and I try to work backwards, you know, like who's not going to be there. I think they have dangled Matthew Perreault before. I think they will do it again.
There was once a time, and this was just before Dale Tallon came back to Florida, when the quote-unquote computer boys were running things with Florida, and they always wanted to get Matthew Perreault. And I think that Winnipeg asked for a Bukestad on the way back, and that ended it. That ended the discussion. But I wonder if there could still be some favor there, even though that regime isn't in Florida anymore. But anyway, it wouldn't surprise me there's a marketplace for Matthew Perreault.
The other thing about Perreault is he told me that the last time that he was a UFA, Toronto was after him. And that was also not the current regime. But I do think that there is going to be one more player possibly who goes from there. And the guy I'm wondering about is Ehlers.
That's a big ticket and not a lot of playoff production.
But again, a young, really talented guy.
But that's what I'm saying. How do you move that? $6 million a copy, and there isn't that body of work that you look at in the postseason and say, we got to get some of that. And again, to the previous point, what did Sam Pollock always say? Legendary GM, Montreal Canadiens, don't make your mind up on a young player until you're 100% certain. How many teams in this era have been burned by giving up on young guys too early?
This is part of like a larger conversation, but it's one I've been debating about how I'm going to tackle in writing. And I've said it a couple times this week, including on Primetime the other day.
To me, this year has been a reminder of me about the toughest thing about being a general manager of the National Hockey League is you have to have two teams. You have to have your regular season team and you have to have your playoff team.
Like the guy I'm looking at right now, I had a long conversation with an exec about him the other day, is Pat Maroon.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at Pat Maroon. Edmonton last year thinks he's going to hit it big in the offseason. They ran the piece where he said it. He gets no offers. Changes agents. He gets 1 year, 1.5 from his hometown team to be with his son. And during the year, they send out an email saying he's available. And he's making nothing by NHL standards. And no one takes him.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in the playoffs, he is unstoppable. He's a down-low monster. And what this exec said to me yesterday was, Patrick Maroon is a dinosaur. But there's nobody in the NHL anymore who knows how to cover dinosaurs. So Mark Bergevin, when he got the job as the GM of the Canadiens, I didn't know him that well, so we met once and we talked. and he tried to explain some of his philosophies to me. And one of the things he said was, there are guys who will get you there, and there are guys who get you through. And Pat Maroon, maybe he doesn't get you there, but he gets you through. And so I think all of these teams now have to say, okay, who gets us there and who gets us through? And this league changes. It changes from game 82 to game one. You have to build two teams.
Two things on Pat Maroon.
Yep.
And this is not a slight on Pat Maroon. Mm-hmm. I happen to like Pat Maroon. I like Pat Maroon when he's playing with
whenever,
the Anaheim Ducks with Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaf.
Just record this. Whenever someone says this is not a slight on Pat Maroon, you know it's about to be a slight on Pat Maroon.
No, I'm just saying the two centermen of recent note that he has played with and enjoyed success are Connor McDavid and now most recently Tyler Bozak. Connor McDavid, as we all know, go to the net, keep your stick down.
Yep.
Go to the net, keep your stick down. And now playing with Tyler Bozak, and listen, that line game three, I know the minutes were, I think that line was only in between like 11 and 13 minutes for all those three players. But that, you know, despite Jaden Schwartz, who had a fantastic game, that to me was the most impressive line. And I can't tell you, and you've probably had a similar experience, how many people who have played with Tyler Bozak who will tell you this, he makes the game easy. When you play with Tyler Bozak, it's a luxury. He's not a big flashy scorer. He's not spectacular like Connor McDavid. But when you ride shotgun with Tyler Bozak, it's an easy game because he does all those little things that nobody else likes to do that just makes it easy for a winger to be a winger. You don't have to do much other than just the assignment you're given because Bozak does the rest of it.
He does a lot of work. He's been underappreciated for what a good 100% player he is.
This is not the slight on Maroon, but the praise on Tyler Bozak. But he is playing on a really intriguing line, too. And we've talked about Robert Thomas before. Almost a year ago at Memorial Cup last year in Regina, we had Robert Thomas on the program, flashy young, you know, future star with the St. Louis Blues. It's an interesting line because it has the centerman that makes it easy for everybody. To your point, the dinosaur, and then this young stud in Robert Thomas that we think is going to be a standout in the NHL. We think him and Jordan Kyrou are going to be those two next big stud forwards for the St. Louis Blues. And I look at Pat Maroon and I'm saying, man, right now in the playoffs, you're in a great spot because you're playing with a guy that makes it easy. And that's Tyler Bozak. The time to hit it for Pat Maroon is now. And that game winner that he scored in game three, sure, Lindell goes down a little bit light in front of
that. Yeah, but Lindell earned that non-call.
I know. Hang on. And that is a very un-Ben Bishop moment.
Yeah.
But still, nonetheless, he scored.
And Tyler Bozak slings it up to the left point. Here's Bullmeister off the wall. Now to the inboards, in behind the net. Maroon in open. He scores! Pat Maroon! He's put it in! And the Blues have taken a 4-3 lead. Minute 38 to go in the third period. What a play by Maroon.
Pat Maroon beating Ben Bishop with a minute 38 remaining. The Blues go back on top.
Bullmeister gets a puck deep. Do you see Maroon right there? He puts his man down.
I think Pat Maroon's in a great spot. I really do.
I agree. And you know what? I think that people are going to look at this and say, if I think I can win, maybe I don't get the best of the regular season from him, but I will get the best of the playoffs. We'll see. We'll see where it goes. There's one story I'd like to tell about Bozak for a second.
Shoot.
And I admit I have a soft spot for him, and here's why. So one of the greatest sports books I've ever read is A Season on the Brink. It's John Feinstein, and it was written about Bob Knight, who was at the height of his powers as a head coach at Indiana in 1986. And this is the year before they win the national championship, and Feinstein gets embedded in the Indiana team, and he writes an incredible book that Bob Knight hated. But in that book, there's a part where he talks about a player at Indiana named Winston Morgan. Now, Winston Morgan had a terrible year one year at Indiana, and Bob Knight had decided he was not going to keep him. Like he had, I think, 1 year left of college eligibility, but Bob Knight decided he's not staying here next year. He's going to have to go somewhere else. And he didn't play him like the last half of the year. And Bob Knight also had an assistant coach on his team, a guy by the name of Jim Cruz. And Jim Cruz was going to get the job next year as the head coach at Evansville University. So they lose early. They have a terrible season.
Yeah.
They lose early. It's a nightmare. and Knight hates his team and his team hates him. And he basically tells Winston Morgan, you're not coming back in a meeting. And Morgan is devastated and he gets up and he sees Jim Cruz sitting there and he says, Coach Cruz, I know you're going to go to Evansville. You're leaving us. I wanted to thank you for everything you did for me. I know you'll do great at Evansville. And Knight tells the reporter that at that moment he changed his opinion on Winston Morgan. He said, any kid that would feel that terrible, that would make sure to thank his coach and say, I know you'll do great, like he says, that's a kid that we can't get rid of. I have to give that kid another chance. So the reason I bring this up with Tyler Bozak is a few years ago during one of their real nightmare seasons, they got knocked out of the playoffs early. It was the year the fans and the Leafs really hate each other and the media and the Leafs really hate each other. Like, it was just a bad, bad, bad year. Well, in game 82, the Leafs brought a young boy to the game who was very ill. And they brought him in the dressing room after the game, and Bozak was unbelievable with this fan. And I've always remembered that Winston Morgan, Bob Knight, Jim Cruz story. Like, who's the guy that treats other people well when they are going through terrible times? And I've always remembered that night about Bozak. Like, in the worst Leaf season in recent memory, he was great to that kid. And I think so were a bunch of other players, but Bozak was the one that I heard about. You know, I've always had time for Bozak. Like, if you're a good person when things are crap, I think that says a lot of good things about you.
Good person, good teammate. Anytime you talk to Phil Kessel, ask him what he thought about playing with Tyler
Bozak. Yeah, he's very good with Bozak.
100%. Back to Winnipeg really quickly. Tyler Myers.
You see, I'd heard there'd been no talks. I saw Myers at one point during the season. I asked him. He said nothing. I checked back in with someone else late in the year. Nothing. I've heard he likes Winnipeg. I heard he has. But from what I heard, he was preparing that he wasn't going to be back. I think they want to bring back Sherratt too. You know,
by the way, Sherratt is sneaky tough for those that don't know. Sneaky tough. Yes. One of those sneaky tough guys.
Yes, he is. And, you know, he's also part of that big, like, Wheeler-Shifley team workout group. So I think they like his commitment.
Certainly true. Okay, off of that page, let's get to Maple Leafs.
Okay.
Let's get to dueling press conferences. Let's get to Mike Babcock and Kyle Dubas.
It's interesting. There's 23 coaches sitting at home today thinking they should have done something different. I thought we really prepared.
In game 7 of the series, I mean, I thought basically we started fine. We allowed the goals, and then we played really well for the middle of the game, and then the third period we couldn't gain any traction.
We started the series. They adjusted. We adjusted back. They adjusted. We adjusted back.
I think that falls on everybody, starting with me, not the coaching staff, not the players.
When you're an athlete and you've held up like Willie did and you come back and it didn't go the way, Willie's a proud guy. He's a great kid.
And we've talked about the Nylander situation here at length. The blame for the situation going that far has to go to me.
We think we're going in the right direction. We still got to add depth to our lineup.
I think the blame should go to me for the penalty kill, because I think I could have done a better job in finding guys that could provide depth to help the coaches in that regard. So I think if there's blame to go around for that, it should go to me.
What did you make of that one? First Mike and then Kyle.
Well, just how different they were. The tone was so different. Like, I had people saying to me, like, why is Kyle Dubas apologizing for the penalty kill?
He didn't block enough shots. That's why.
from the suite. Not enough of them got up there. I had people saying to me, why is he apologizing for that? That's got nothing to do with him. And I said, you're missing it. If that's the way you're looking at it, you're missing the point. Like, it's like the captain of the Titanic, right? Like, you go down with the ship. If you're the person at the top of the masthead, you get credit for things you don't do, and you take blame for things you're not responsible for. That's the way it goes. And that's the way life is. If you're the general manager and the team doesn't win, you throw yourself on the grenade. So I totally understand what he's doing.
I looked at Dubas really quickly and I said to myself, right now he's recruiting. Right now, that is his behavior, and him accepting responsibility is sending the message to other players on his team, either potential unrestricted free agents, that this is who accepts responsibility here, and whether it's your fault for whatever, I'm the leader and I'm the one diving on the grenade.
Well, I think there's truth to that. I think that's very reasonable.
That was a nice bit of recruiting by Kyle Dubas.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you. I also do think that he believes that the buck stops with him, and that's the way it has to be. You know, Babcock's one was interesting. The Wii thing I thought was really interesting in terms of we'll decide who plays. I think it's really interesting because it's clear those two guys don't share the same philosophy. So now what you have to figure out is, can they work together long term? Mm-hmm. See, I don't think it's a problem if the head coach and the general manager disagree, as long as they both are pointed in the same direction. I think they're both pointed in the same direction in terms of they want to win the Stanley Cup, but they don't agree on how to get there.
Kyle Dubas, in his previous capacity as general manager of the Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds, there was one of the Sloan conferences where he talked about everybody pulling in the same direction, like everybody in the organization, everybody being on the same page. Everybody brings their own specialty. Everyone brings their own perspective. Everyone brings their own bias, whatever, to every position that they're in. But he talked about all swimming up the same stream the same way. They're all tugging. All the cliches apply here. I won't bore anyone with more of them. But I can recall when Kyle was in Sioux and Sheldon Keefe was his head coach. This is the Ontario Hockey League, and this is teams without a huge budget.
We see here, this is year two in Sault Ste. Marie. So we're on this slope downward. This is cumulative shot differential or possession or whatever you want to call it, Corsi, Sat, whatever they've branded it now. And right here, we make a coaching change. In that season, with Sheldon Keefe as our coach, we went from being, in the first 30 games, our Corsi percentage was 47%. In the remaining 38 games, it was 57%. It's a 21% difference in our shot differential or percent or possession percentage. And that's the same exact same roster, different coach. What I learned at that time was the extreme value of having buy-in all throughout your organization, the fact that that takes time. If your president, general manager, coach, scouts, everybody buys into using what you can gain from statistics and analytics, you're going to have a lot more success than if you have one person on your staff alone saying this is important and trying to gather buy-in from everybody else.
But this is a Kyle Dubas, Sheldon Keefe team that put a premium on quote-unquote analytics and measuring things like zone entries, possession time, all of that. But there's no budget or even software technology that they could afford to track all that. So they would bring, and I think it was a young guy, and I forget his name, but he handled ticketing. The Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds, and he would travel with the team, and he would sit in the stands, and he would count zone entries, and he would just be like check marks on a box. I remember thinking to myself, this is one entire organization that is doing what Kyle Dubas is talking about, everybody pulling the same way.
Yeah.
So that's what I know about Kyle Dubas and how he ran a team previous. And then I look at Kyle Dubas as the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I've always asked myself the same question. Is he getting the same buy-in from everyone around him the way that he did in Sault Ste. Marie? I don't know many of us that would look at that situation and say, yeah, he is.
I think Babcock is coming back. He certainly left it open. Dubas did in his media conference. I think there's a chance the assistants change. You know, we know that DJ Smith has permission to interview in Ottawa. If Mark Hunter is the next GM in Edmonton, I believe that Smith will be a candidate there. I've heard that there are teams interested in Jim Hiller. He's got a connection with Joel Quenneville. I believe the Islanders interviewed him or wanted to interview him last year before Trotz became available. I think there's more. I wrote in the blog that Buffalo might be interested in Keefe. Someone said to me, what you didn't ask was if Keefe thinks his best opportunity is Buffalo. It's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts. I think Babcock is coming back. But the one thing that I don't know here is, and I wrote this too, what happens if someone like Buffalo calls and says, could we talk to Babcock?
So just to Babcock?
Yeah.
Or to Keefe?
I think they will ask to see if they can interview Keefe. I heard they are really impressed. I heard the pressure in Buffalo is to get someone with experience. This is what happened last time. Now you do the reverse this time. What happens if they ask to speak to Babcock?
To be blunt, I had never considered that.
I have no insight that this is what they would even think about. It just popped up to me as I've been thinking about all this. Like, what if Buffalo said, you know, we want a coach with experience.
We tried before.
What are we doing here?
Well, the normal course of business is you wait until a coach is dismissed at the NHL before asking a team's permission to talk to him. To my knowledge, I don't know this has been done before. I mean, certainly there have been teams that have talked to coaches on the side.
Yeah.
We all know that. But I don't know a NHL team that has called another team to say, can I speak to your current head coach about a position?
I don't even think this is a question solely of whether or not Dubas wants to make a change. I think it's also a question of, is there any chance, and I don't know, I'm just asking, is there any chance Babcock would want to change?
I don't know Mike Babcock that well. I just know how competitive he is, and I don't see many coaches that throw in the towel like that. That would back away.
I don't even think it's backing away or
quitting. I don't
quitting.
See many coaches that say, I've had enough. Like, listen, Rocket Richard said, I've had enough of the Quebec Nordiques after, what, 1-2 games.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure at a certain point, you know, pretty quickly, Wayne Gretzky said, you know what, this coaching thing that I thought was so simple, it's really not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know many coaches that have said, yeah, I think I'm done here, and I'm going to walk away from it. It's an interesting question, but why not throw it on the table?
To me, the
interesting one is if you're keeping Sheldon Keefe in your back pocket, knowing that down the road, this is going to be your guy,
mm-hmm.
and someone approaches you right now to talk to him, not unlike how Colorado had approached the Maple Leafs about talking to assistant general manager Kyle Dubas once upon a time, what do you do? That forces your hand. You know, the Chicago Blackhawks hired Joel Quenneville as a scout, Denny Savard's the head coach. Well, why did you hire Joel Quenneville as a scout? You really intended him to be your scout? No. He was there because he was the coach in waiting.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a delicate one. I don't know that it's as intriguing as the Mitch Marner negotiations are going to be, but there's more than a handful of great stories this year in the offseason for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yep.
Let's get to the Mitch Marner situation. How do you see this one playing out?
By the way, one thing I want to just mention before I forget about Mikhaev. I wrote in the notes that my Russian guys were telling me that Ilya Mikhaev was going to be a Leaf. The one thing I was told is that I think Vegas and Chicago are still going to pitch him,
mm-hmm.
but he's Toronto's to lose.
Walking right into the NHL next season?
I think so. I've heard Babcock's a fan, and that's why Babcock referenced him after the loss in Boston.
Is there a spot for Igor Korshkov? Next season or one more year seasoning with the American League?
It sounds to me like they want him to play in the NHL.
I feel bad for a lot of those early second round guys in that Matthews draft.
What's that?
Because it won't just be that player. It'll be the player they chose ahead of Alex DeBrincat and Samuel Girard.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Mitch Marner, that situation. Yep. Where are we at? Kyle Dubas sort of gave himself the deadline. Listen, we got to get this guy done because July 1st, no business can be done until we know that number. And you've hinted at offer sheet before, and do you think that that was Kyle Dubas' way publicly of acknowledging that an offer sheet could be coming for Marner?
Like, I've had people say to me this year, or tweet at me this year, would you stop with the offer sheets? There's no offer sheets. And that's fine. Like, people can agree to disagree. The actions of the Maple Leafs in this particular case say to me that they believe it's a possibility. They think it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that matters. Toronto is acting like a team that believes there's an offer sheet on the way. So that's the way you have to approach it. It's the only way you can approach it. Now, I was on, as I mentioned earlier, primetime on Tuesday night. I don't even know what day it is anymore, by the way. Like, I really don't know. But Tuesday, I think
you're
it was.
In witness relocation right now. Yeah. Doing TV every night.
No idea what day it is anymore. But it was Tuesday, and I said that.
Give me your best guess. What's Marner asking for? What are the Maple Leafs going to offer?
Matthews.
Marner. What is Marner
Marner's
asking
gonna get,
for?
Marner's going to get Matthews is what you're saying,
he's
right?
He's asking for Matthews.
Oh, I yeah. see. He wants.
That's what I think.
11-5, 11-6.
Yeah.
And before I'd even gotten off the air, I had people texting me saying, well, you got to be careful of the language because I don't think Marner has technically asked for anything yet. Mm-hmm. And I said, is it wrong that I'm saying he's targeting the Matthews contract? And they're like, well, no, not wrong about that. And it wasn't even the agent. It was like someone on the periphery and saying what they've been told. So I think that that's what they want. I think. I don't think there's ever been a number exchange, but I think that's what they want. The highest paid winger in the league is Kane, 10.5. Leafs don't want to go there. I think their preference, if they have to, is in the Stone Kucherov range. Mm-hmm. They've signed extensions within the last calendar year at 9.5, although they both live in no tax states.
Thank you.
I think that they know that this is going to be probably going to be around a double digit number. What I think this is that the Maple Leafs, I think, are legitimately surprised it's gotten to this.
Why, but, though? I mean, Darren Ferris, the agent, said we're not interested in negotiating during the year, and Dubas was public about saying we respect that.
I just think they never thought it would be this difficult.
Has it got difficult yet, though? Like we're
It's difficult.
We're still,
this is
the beginning of May.
Even though they said there's no negotiation, I think both sides have been unhappy with things that have been reported. I think the organization believed that Marner was a Toronto kid who wanted to play for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and they always believed it would get done. Mm-hmm. I'm playing amateur psychologist here, but one thing about Marner is you get the sense is, and I can appreciate this because I have felt this way in my career at times too, is that you feel that you're not considered important enough. Okay. Actually, I've never felt like that in my career, but I have had a chip in my shoulder at times because I felt that you're not respected for what you do.
Okay.
And I haven't felt that way recently. A lot of that stuff was early in my career. And the reason I'm equating it with Marner is because he's early in his career. And, you know, there's a guy there who was drafted fourth overall. People ripped that pick at the time. It's turned out to be a great pick.
Yep.
He was sent back down to junior, and the Leafs were very blunt about why he was sent to junior. He didn't get the full bonuses in his first contract, which has continued to be a thing, even though it was a Lou Lamoriello kind of rule.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone around him is convinced that Mitch Marner is not respected the way he should be respected. And I think the organization looks at it like you're a cornerstone player. You're going to get paid a lot of money. Does it really matter you're not going to get paid the same level as Matthews? And I will say I have been in one negotiation in my career where it really went off the rails because I felt the same exact way that Marner is right now. And when I look back at it with the experience of life, I think that my attitude served me well, but it also could have really hurt me. It could have derailed my career in a way where I wouldn't be where I am now.
So,
and that is the only thing I would say to Mitch Marner. I would say is, this is your life. This is your choice. You do what you want to do, but make sure it's not a decision that in, you know, 10 years we'll be looking back at with regret.
I understand everything. I understand all of that. Mm-hmm. Is the Marner camp perspective, why should our guy be asked to take the hit? Well, it wasn't anybody else. Why is it our guy?
Well, I think it's tough to say because I think a lot of people listening will hear the money involved and say you shouldn't call that a hit. So
yeah, but one man's ceiling is another man's floor.
I get that. I think sometimes when we're talking about these numbers, the fans go bananas.
I get it.
But yes, I do think there is some of that. I mean, I think Toronto will make an argument that Tavares took a hit. He could have made more money elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I admire Mitch Marner because I think that he has done a lot more than people expected of him. There were people who believed that he was going to be good, but I don't know how many people thought he was going to be this good.
Mm-hmm.
And he has taken people's expectations and he has shoved them up right up there.
Yep.
And I think what you have to realize is that sometimes when you deal with people like that, that attitude extends to everything. I think that's the one thing I would just say to Marner is, because I've been there. I know exactly what he's going through. I have gone through negotiations like this.
Yeah.
And the one thing that really in a lot of ways saved my career, Jeff, was me sitting down one night and saying, Are you sure?
You see, what I always end up saying to myself is, where can you be you? My whole career, I've always said, don't let money get in the way of doing what you want to do. Right? Now, mm-hmm. that changes with life
when
and responsibilities and kids and mortgages.
Life
and all these
throws curveballs at you.
100%. 100%.
You plan, God laughs.
Exactly. That's a great line, by the way. Your grandma, right?
Yeah,
that's
grandma,
a great
yeah.
line. And I always would say to myself, where can I most be me? Where can I be happy being me? And the question that I always have for anybody is, you know, where are you happiest being you? Or mm-hmm. which place is going to allow you to be you? And as it relates to Marner, I say to myself, if I'm Mitch Marner, I'm saying that, where can I be me the most? I understand, oh, I want to make a little bit more than this guy. It's a totem pole of respect as it's perceived within the Brotherhood of the Players Association. I understand all that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're by yourself and you're thinking, you're going for a walk, you're taking your dog for a walk, you're doing whatever. And you say to yourself, where can I be me the most? I find that is generally the place that I want to be.
I agree.
You can chase an extra dollar. What did Bob McCowan always say?
Don't F with happy.
Don't F with happy.
Yeah.
Where can you be you?
Yeah.
So those are some of the decisions on the horizon for the Toronto Maple Leafs. What else should we pay attention to? There's a Kasperi Kapanen issue.
I think all of this stuff sorts itself out to some degree when they know what Marner's situation
is. You don't think Maple Leafs might be facing two offer sheets this summer, one for Kapanen?
It's possible. Like, I think it is possible, but as far as their decisions go, it's Marner first and everything else after.
And Dubé said that.
It's true, but I think that's true.
Edmonton.
Yeah.
The Oilers, speaking of choices. Now, we're recording this podcast, as Elliot mentioned. It is now 2:35 Eastern on Wednesday. By the time you hear this, a decision may already be made because I'm told we're going to find out pretty soon about this.
Yes.
What's happening in Edmonton?
So, this week, I expect the Oilers to get clarity now that the under-18s are over on Kelly McCrimmon and Ken Holland. From what I could tell, the Oilers did not have the official written permission to interview Kelly McCrimmon yet. So they were hoping to get that this week.
Okay.
I've been on Ken Holland since the beginning. He's the guy I believe was the number one on Bob Nicholson's list. I think they'll also find out this week if Ken Holland is a legit contender and legitimately interested. If Ken Holland is interested, I would not be surprised in the least if they offer him the job and see what he says.
What do you think about that?
I don't know. I don't know.
Things changed in Detroit with Yzerman.
Now, they took care of Holland, though. They gave him a big extension.
For sure.
I'm told it starts with a 3.
Oh, wow.
So they took care of him. He can sit there and take his time. And the other thing I heard, too, and I don't know if it'll work this way, but one of the things I've heard is that Steve Yzerman legitimately wanted Ken Holland there, and he wants him there to bounce ideas off of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether...
Is that enough for Ken Holland, though?
Well, I don't know. Like, you know, think about it. He's been in the same chair for over 20 years. Sometimes you just need some time to decompress and think and see what else is out there. That's the biggest question. Does he want to decompress, or does he want to go right back to work? Now, the one thing I will say is, guys told me that Ken Holland worked hard last year. Like some guys, you know, whether they get older or they know that there could be a change, they're not as invested.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the problem with Ken Holland. Like, he worked hard last season. Whether you liked his stuff or not, he worked. And based on that, this is not a person who's ready to retire. This is someone who wanted to prove that he could turn the Red Wings around,
mm-hmm.
felt that he could do the job, and there'd be a lot of people who would just take the money and sit and be an advisor. But these people said to me, if Ken Holland really felt like he wanted to jump back in, it wouldn't surprise them because he's still got the edge that he wants to do the job.
So let's say that he still wants to have two hands on the wheel and he doesn't want to just make suggestions which way to turn from the back seat.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, I'll interview for the Edmonton job. And Bob Nicholson offers it to him. How does that fan base react? We've talked about this
well,
before.
I've had
Don't
guys,
let your fan base yeah, make yeah. your decisions for you. I get that.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. They had a big meeting with season ticket holders the other day, and they showed a lot of things they're doing to keep the season ticket holders happy. like adding perks on the side and not raising some of the tickets. So they're at work already. You know, I think there will be people who don't like it, but I'm sure there'll be people who like it. After I wrote the list of guys, and I forgot somebody, Bill Zito interviewed for Edmonton.
He had Sean Burke, John Ferguson, Mike Fuda,
Ross Mahoney. Scott Mellenby and Verbeek, and I left out Bill Zito. That's the name somebody told me I didn't put in there. What somebody told me is that not everybody suggested a quick recovery. Like apparently there were some people there who said, you're going to have to take some more pain if you want to do this right.
One of the candidates said that?
And maybe more than one. They said that the way you get yourself into trouble is you try to trade your way out of these problems.
Sure.
You may have to take a couple years more pain to get better.
How would that be received by Bob Nicholson initially and the fan base second?
I don't know.
I'm guessing not well.
Well, you take a look at Ken Holland. He's done it both ways in Detroit, right? Like Detroit's way was we're keeping our playoff streak alive. So he made moves to keep their playoff streak alive.
Oh, yeah. They stayed out of the first round. And,
and that was, yeah. But that was what it was. Like, but if you take a look at it now, Larkin looks like he's a player.
Oh, going away.
Athanasiou looks like he's a player. Mm-hmm.
Anthony Mantha.
Mantha, up and down, but he's still there. Like
Bertuzzi.
Bertuzzi looked like he's a player. And they are stocked with picks and prospects. Like, yeah. I know there have been people killing Holland in the interim, but when this team is good again, a lot of his pieces, whether draft picks or prospects, sure, are going to be part of it. And people are going to notice that. So he's done it both ways. I'm curious to know what he's going
to
say.
See, I'm curious to know what Bob Nicholson believes. Ultimately, he's going to be the one making the decision.
Yes.
And you have two candidates coming in. One candidate says, we can turn this thing around. This offseason, we're off to the races. We're back in the playoffs. The other says, not so fast. That's fool's gold. We still need at least another year, maybe two of pain. You're Bob Nicholson, who you decide on.
If I really believe that the guy who says two more years is right, I go there. Now, I realize I'm not sitting in that chair, but if you bring somebody in and they make a bunch of trades that go badly, now maybe it can go well, but if they go badly, that's always tied to you. That's one thing where you have to go to McDavid and say, this is what we're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What I bet what McDavid's answer would be is, I'll give you the year to see that I believe that in what you're doing. But I think it's really interesting that guys would go in there and say, okay, this is going to take some time.
Just as an aside, before we get to another team here, and we might as well get to Detroit because that's the natural, after just talking about Ken Holland, the natural on-ramp. How common is it when there's a GM position available at this time of the year, this close to the draft? A lot of assistant GMs from other teams will, of course, be candidates and will be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
How often are they shut out from meetings with their own team because of it? I'm not saying this is happening in Edmonton, but just a jumping off point.
There's a well-known story. The guy said, the story is true, but you can't say my name. Where a few years ago, he got told by his GM, go wait in your office. I can't have you in our meetings. And he sat in his office all day. And I think that his access to the computers were turned off, like the team system.
Oh, yeah.
And then at the end of the day, the GM walked in and said, oh, yeah, another team's asked for permission. And I think they're going to want to hire you. So I couldn't have you around. He says, you couldn't have told me that like 8 hours ago. You couldn't have, like, sent me home? But that's my favorite story.
Well, I only bring it up because one of the themes of this podcast is, how does this work? And I think a lot of people perhaps will look
at whether
it's people that are employed by teams. And this has been sensitive for a long time. Even, you know, last time the draft was in Vancouver in 2006, it's back in Vancouver this year.
Yes.
You know, there was the situation, you know, Ron Hextall leaves Philadelphia and goes to L.A. And the first thing I thought of, like, he's been in all these meetings. He's got their list. He's been in all these prospect meetings for that draft. I always wonder about GMs and AGMs that are interviewed this close to the draft and what happens to them on their teams at that moment.
Well, last year, Tom Kervers worked for Tampa Bay, mm-hmm. and he was going to Minnesota, and Tampa Bay wouldn't let him sit at their table.
Right.
So that does happen in some ways.
All right, Detroit. Mentioned Ken Holland. Your thoughts on Steve Yzerman? Not exactly a surprise.
No.
This one was, the die was cast many months ago.
Well, there's a few things there. Number one, I think there were people who believed Detroit would potentially be an offer sheet team. And now,
still think?
I don't know. I have learned not to presume to guess anything when it comes to Steve Yzerman. You know, also there was the Datsyuk thing. I heard that Detroit had at least considered the possibility of bringing him back for a year. Now, Datsyuk announced on Twitter and Instagram the other night that he's not going back to St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
And he is going to Michigan for a while, I think, starting next week. Now, there is a report that he's going to his hometown team. But I've been told it's not likely he's going to be with the Red Wings.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely going to his hometown team, Ekaterinburg, I believe it is. You know, they at least discussed it. You know, I think Yzerman, I've heard he's really invigorated. I heard he's really excited.
Yep.
I think the other thing we're kind of wondering is who from Tampa is going to go with him. If Pat Verbeek doesn't get the Edmonton GM job and it doesn't look like it, is he going with him?
Mm-hmm.
Is Al Murray a scout who's got a lot of good credit? Is he going with him?
That's a...
You know, the big question people have, and nobody knows if it's true, is if Al Murray has like an Yzerman out in his contract.
Al Murray, for those that don't know, he's top of game when it comes to amateur scouting. You look at how Al Murray has stocked those Tampa cupboards. That would be, I know it's always, oh, Pat Verbeek, the sexy name comes in. It's Steve Yzerman, the big sexy name comes in. For those in the know, you pick off someone like Al Murray.
We won't get any confirmation of it, but word from a couple of scouts I've heard is that they believe he's got it out for Yzerman. So we'll see.
It's happening in Vancouver. The Canucks, never a dull moment there.
I think that what the Vancouver media should do is start sending out names every day of people they've heard are potentially interested in, the Canucks are potentially interested in for the president a job, because Francesco Aquilini goes on and denies all of them, so we can start eliminating names. He said no on Lombardi, he said no on Gillis about a job. Here's what I heard about Gillis. Aquilini and Gillis have a lot of mutual friends. Aquilini, of course, has been in Vancouver a long time. I believe Gillis now lives in Victoria. And I think Aquilini had started to ask, was there any way he would ever consider coming back? Just if I thought about it. And I think, you know, they talked about it, and I heard he sent Gillis a text. And the reports that he was coming back, I heard, were presumptuous. Like, I don't think there was ever a job offer. When he tweets there was no job offer, I believe that to be true. But I do think that he'd reached out, and I think there was at least the possibility of a meeting and then maybe something. But now that it got out, I mean, maybe Aquilini is mad. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I think that the Canucks should do is they should come out and say, are they looking for someone else? Are they trying to add? Yes or no? And just say it one way or the other.
You owe it to the marketplace. You owe it to
the general manager. If you're trying to have Jim Benning set a plan, this is not productive. So say one thing or the other.
What do you think?
It says to me that they've at least looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
I know Aquilini said that they haven't reached out to Lombardi. I think last summer, before last summer, during last season, 17-18, I'd heard that they did. I know some of the Vancouver media have reported they did this year. I hadn't heard that. I don't know. But I think they have in the past.
You put one note. I love when you do these sneaky notes, because normally, as you know, the guys like to chide you about, it's not 31 thoughts, it's about 31 stories, 31...
Or 15 thoughts into 31.
I like your little lyrical flourishes, your little mini soloettes. You just have a one-line boom. PK?
Well, John Shannon was the one who brought up PK's name on Hockey Central. You were doing that show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then PK was asked about it, and he gave a great answer. Boy, those Nashville guys on their breakaway day, they had some really interesting
answers to
questions. Subban did, and Laviolette in the power play. And so, you see, my point with Nashville is one of the reasons, I mean, they're great defensively. They had a 3-2 power play, 3 forwards and 2D, and they might change that. They're one of the last teams to do it.
Bombs away from the point.
Yeah, and the bombs away from the point. They're one of the last teams to believe in the slaps that they might go away. Like, their strength is their D. So if they move anyone, it makes sense, especially if they're going to change personnel. So I don't know. I haven't heard Subban's name, but if it is, Vancouver really wanted him in 2016. They wanted to make that deal.
And what, if Montreal gets Pierre-Luc Dubois,
he was there
before.
And people there have confirmed that for me. They said that is true, okay. That they really thought they were going to get him if Dubois. But once they knew that Columbus wasn't letting Dubois get past three, that deal fell apart. And what would make you think that Vancouver would feel any differently now? There's nothing in PK's game that makes me think I'd be afraid to trade for him.
See, the whispers are all out there. They're going big game hunting for a blue liner.
Vancouver?
Whether it's Carlson, whether it's, listen, if,
you know, doesn't actually, like, I heard,
as you mentioned, you know, Myers isn't probably going to go back with the Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah.
That could be an option should they not get Eric Carlson or whomever.
I heard San Jose is still making a big run to try to re-sign Carlson.
Is that right? Huh?
Yeah. Someone said to me that's not over.
Just talking about the Vancouver Canucks, I want to pause for a second here on the podcast and mention the passing of Jason Botchford, who passed away at the age of 48. Our condolences to the family and to the friends of Jason, and certainly to not only them, but also his colleagues at The Athletic and at TSN as well, Elliot.
Well, first of all, I thought the Vancouver Province wrote a fantastic story about him today, and the stories that they told about him saying, like, that's a stupid story, I'm not writing that. And then the next day kind of saying, well, look, if you want me to write the story, then just ask me to do it. I thought that was, from what I know about Botchford, I thought that was a perfect anecdote, and I thought that was really well done. I mean, obviously a lot of people are in shock. 48 years old should never happen. Young families should never happen. You know, those are the people I ache for today. When it comes to the Canucks and covering the Canucks, there's people who set the tone in the market. And the play-by-play guys, I find, are separate from the reporters. Mm-hmm. You go from Jim Robson to Jim Houston to John Shorthouse. And the thing about Vancouver that they're really lucky about on that side is Jim Robson was a legend. And Jim Houston was unafraid to step into those shoes, and he was a legend. And I think Shorthouse has done the same. Like, I don't think it's easy to follow a guy like Jim Houston, and Shorthouse has done an unbelievable job. I think he's one of the best in the league. And then on the analyst side, you had Tom Larscheid, and now you've got John Garrett, who I think is hilarious on the air. And then on the print side, you had Tony Gallagher, and Tony Gallagher covered the Canucks with an edge. If you got on his bad side, you knew it, and the market like that. And Botchford was the first guy really to get to grab the market like Gallagher did. And in the obit in the Province, they talk about, I can't remember which guy was quoted as saying it, but they talked about how they're trying to change the game story. And that's a big thing in sports writing, is we can't do game stories anymore because everybody watches and they're outdated.
Yeah.
And there were so many people who came up with ideas and or failed to come up with ideas, and Botchford found the idea. The Athletics was the go-to piece about the Vancouver, and before that, the Provies, was the go-to piece in the Vancouver market on the Canucks. It dictated the coverage. I think that's hard to do. I think it shows the deep respect he had in the market, that the way he covered the team resonated more than anyone since Tony Gallagher had essentially stepped away from day to day. And in a market as big and as competitive as Vancouver, that is incredible. That is a real indication of his talent. It is hard to be the tone setter in your market, and Jason Botchford was that. There were some people who didn't like Botchford because of that, whether they were fans or people in the media. I always tell people that's okay. There are always people who aren't going to like you. At the end of the day, you have to be true to yourself, and you had to be true to your family. And he was true to himself. There were times he praised me in his column. There were times he ripped me in his column. I never had a problem with it. He treated me just like he treated everybody else. I really respected that.
He had no time for me, which is okay.
You weren't the only one.
We had it. No, I know. If Jason doesn't like you, don't feel special. Mm-hmm. I get it. And that's fine. We had an uncomfortable couple of exchanges after I did a couple of hits on Vancouver radio, which was fine. And then we just sort of stayed away from each other. And I've always sort of prided myself on the ability not to make enemies and generally get along with everybody. I don't think it's worth it to have enemies. I would never consider Jason being an enemy. It's just he didn't like me, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Not this is about me, because this is about his family, and this is about that family that has to go on without Jason. Whenever I have someone that doesn't like me,
mm-hmm.
or I don't like someone else, I always say to myself, one day it's all going to be okay. One day I'll make peace with that person. And so when I saw the news about Jason today, I said to myself, and we all get these reminders every now and then, make peace with people.
Yeah.
Don't wait. I've done it, and I've waited, and I've regretted. And today was another one. I always thought somewhere down the road I would make peace with Jason Botchford, and now I won't. Now I can't.
If you guys would have met, and I don't know him as well, obviously, as some of the Vancouver guys do, obviously, but if you guys would have met, you guys would have been just fine. So, for example, last year I went on a rant about the Canucks fans, and I meant it as a joke, but it got out of hand. You know, Botchford took a healthy run at me in his blog, and I was fine with that. I knew that was going to – I saw the way it was going, and I was fine. And then I had to go out there because the Islanders were out there and were doing a piece with Matthew Barzal. Turned out it was right after. So I walked into the press box that night, and he just laughed. He's like, what are you doing here? And I go, I'm here. And I go, do you want to talk to me? I'm not going to run away from you. And he goes, absolutely. And we had a really good, funny conversation, and he wrote about it. And there were times like we would send each other notes. Not a lot, but there was one time there was something in his column. I could tell, you could tell when in his column when he was bothered by something. Like it wasn't just bothered in a professional sense. It bothered him in a personal sense. And I sent him a note and I said, look, I saw this and like, are you okay here? And he's like, well, what do you think? And I wrote, this is what I'm thinking. And he wrote, that's exactly it. And I wrote something back and he wrote back, thanks. That's all it needed to be. And it never changed the way he covered me, good or bad. Like there were times after that he was critical of takes I had.
Yeah.
But that was fine. Like it's so hard to talk about because I can't help but think of the family every time we think
Absolutely.
About this. But honestly, Jeff, like I think he was the kind of guy that he could disagree with you in a professional sense and see the personal side different. After I did that talk with him, after that rant about the fans, I had one media member call me up and say, you know, how can you talk to that guy? And I said, you got to separate the professional from the personal. And you can't do this job properly without running afoul of people in the business. Okay? So a few years ago, there was an article in the Globe and Mail. It was an excerpt from Buzz Hargrove's book. Buzz Hargrove, for those of you who don't know, he used to be the lead of the United Auto Workers in Canada. And one year, Mike Harris, who was the premier of Ontario, who was no friend of the auto workers, he called him up and he wished him Merry Christmas. And Buzz Hargrove's like, what? Are you trying to get something from me? He says, you're never going to get something from me by wishing me Merry Christmas. And Mike Harris said, Buzz, I'm not trying to get anything from you. We may disagree, but I want you to have a Merry Christmas. And Hargrove said he was blown away by that. And I remembered that. Like, you know, there's a lot of people I try to wish Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to. Like, there's some guys we've crossed the lines with each other, and I won't do it because I don't think they would appreciate it from me. But there's other guys I just say, hey, I know we disagree, but I hope you do great, and I hope you have a great year. And that's the way I always felt about Botchford. We could disagree professionally, but I always felt he was the right guy personally.
Well said. Again, condolences to the friends and the family and the colleagues of Jason Botchford. Thoughts is brought to you by the next generation GMC Sierra Denali, complete with the world's first six-function multi-pro tailgate. Nets sliding around on the way to pond hockey? Use the built-in load stop to help keep them in place. Loading what seems like half a team's worth of bags, the tailgate also turns into a step for easier access and has an inner gate that flips down for unloading all the gear you can fit. GMC Sierra Denali. We are professional grade. Okay, a couple of things. Want to get to our hashtag Ask31 Elliot, but really quickly, I was really happy to see you write about the San Jose Sharks and Ryerson assistant coach Nathaniel Brooks. You know what it made me think of?
What's that?
An interesting exchange with Kevin Bieksa this year on ice surfing. And so, as we all know, played with the Vancouver Canucks, played with the Anaheim Ducks, and I thought asking him who the toughest team he played against in the Western Conference consistently year in and year out might get some fertile ground, might get a good answer. And he said San Jose. I said, why San Jose? And I thought he'd be like, oh, big Joe Thornton, big bodies and all that. He said, they kept me and everybody guessing. I said, how? He said, nobody breaks the puck out as differently as the San Jose Sharks does. You never know what breakout they're going to use because they have so many. So when I saw you write that about Brooks, talking about how he bases his system on the Sharks play, smart move.
Yeah.
No one breaks the puck out better than San Jose, according to Kevin Bieksa. Who would know?
Who would know? He sure faced them a lot.
Let's get to Ask 31 from Matt. Hey, Frege and Jeff. Writing in as a Bruins supporter, but deep hockey fan in general, is it too early to start to consider what Chara's legacy in Boston and impact on the greater game might look like?
Well, I think he's getting his number retired there. Nobody's going to wear 33 after he's done there, just like nobody will wear 37, and I wonder if nobody will wear 63.
Boston is running out of numbers, by the way.
They might have to go into triple digits sometime soon. You know, I think his legacy also, too, will be the way people took care of themselves. I think he was ahead of the curve physically, you know, biking. He told me a couple of years ago that he was embracing veganism.
Yep.
I sent him an article about Kyrie Irving, who was traded to the Celtics, also embracing veganism. And he sent me back a note saying, you know, if you ever see more of this stuff, send it. Look, he's going to the Hall of Fame. He's going to get his number retired. He's going to have at least one Stanley Cup ring. I'm going to be curious to see what he does after hockey.
With the million languages he speaks and the million different job opportunities he'll have.
And the millions he's saved up.
Selling houses all over the world. Fascinating guy. And you know what? He, much like Eric Lindros, opened the door for guys like Chris Gratton to walk in and make a ton of dough. Like after Eric Lindros, everybody wanted the big center that could move his feet. Previous, you just look at big center, you go, oh, he's a big gorilla. Oh, he's a big lug. He's not going to be able to get around the rink. Man, Chara opened the door for huge defensemen. Like, the minute you saw Chara succeeding with the Ottawa Senators, there was kind of a race to copycat league to try to find their own version of Chara, where once upon a time you'd see a raw guy who was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Scouts would say, forget about it, too much of a project, never going to work out. Those guys can't play in the NHL until Chara came along. And then all of a sudden those big, huge giraffes started to get second looks. And they went from being cast-offs to projects for teams.
Yes.
You see it every year. From CAD V27, what are the chances Dallas re-signs Zuccarello this summer?
I think they're very reasonable. They love him.
Why not?
Yeah. He's been huge for them.
And they
put it this way. Like, when I've asked, I've been told, don't dismiss it. I think they're decent.
And they finally found their second-line center in Dallas, by the way, in Rupe Hintz.
Hintz, yeah.
That line with Dickinson. Okay. Oh.
So you remember last summer there was a rumor going around that the Carlson deal was done and it wasn't done?
That was Tyler Seguin day.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that was Dallas.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, I think Hintz was supposed to be part of that.
Yeah, correct. I think the Ottawa also asked for Miro Heiskanen.
That wasn't happening. But I think
Ty DeLandria may have been in that conversation.
I think Hintz was in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
From Kurt in present day, should hockey follow lacrosse's lead and end a 5-minute power play after 2 power play goals are scored? They end minors after 1 goal. Not sure why they don't end majors after 2.
Stop, stop. No.
Listen, if.
stop.
If Vegas has a problem.
No.
No.
Next.
Can I sell you on 2-minute majors? No?
No.
Full two? No. All right.
Next.
Jamie Henderson, how would you feel if the NHL started broadcasting the referee conversations during video reviews and huddles like they do in rugby? I feel like it would really help with transparency.
I'm all for it.
Why are real-time explanations of calls limited to the coaches?
I am all for it. I don't know if it'll ever happen, but I am all for it.
I really don't think the NHL is going to allow those conversations.
I agree, but I'm all for it.
We used to do it at the CHL broadcasts. For video reviews, we would go up to the booth and hear the conversations and the phone call.
That's smart.
It was fascinating.
Then I wonder, that says to me that the NHL probably watched all those and said, we're not doing
no
that.
No way. Yeah. From Keith, obviously still in the embryonic stages of the offseason, but with the number 2 overall pick, Adam Fox, and the plethora of young Russian talent the Rangers have on the way, how quick do you see the Rangers making a turnaround?
Well, I think this is going to be a really interesting summer for them. I think they want this rebuild to start coming to an end and some real games starting to matter. I think they're going to be really busy this summer. They've got a ton of picks. They've got a lot of cap room. By a lot of the big markets being out of the playoffs, the cap may not go up as much as everybody thought. A couple of teams are kind of preparing for that now. So the Rangers are going to have room, and if you're going to need to trade players, they're going to want good players. They're going to be out there. Now, the other thing, too, is I had heard their name about as an offer sheet possibility.
Mm-hmm.
They traded their 3rd-round pick next year conditionally to Carolina.
Which can turn into
a 2nd if Fox plays 30 games. Now, the conditional picks are always weird, though. Now, the other thing, too, is to eliminate the problem, they can make a change, right? Like, they can, say, okay, we're going to make it an official 2nd-rounder or something like that. You can always get around that kind of thing. Put it this way. People say that the Rangers are going to be using all of their muscle this year to get better.
What was the first team that started to use analytics at the NHL level? And is there still any teams, or are there any teams, that don't use it?
The team that is probably associated with it the least is Anaheim. I don't know if I would say they don't use it. I suspect with Aikens at the American Hockey League level, there's something.
Yep.
But I don't know how much at the NHL level. The earliest, I think people have kept track. Like, people told me that Scotty Bowman used to keep track of who won battles, mm-hmm. or who recovered the puck, or who got it out. Maybe analytics are new as the way people call them now in terms of what gets done. But I think there's always been different stuff done.
Roger Nilsson was the first in this sort of era of hockey, to my knowledge. Now, Roger would have assistant coaches tracking things like face-off wins, and Roger would play those percentages. Do I want Daryl Sutter to take this draw? Do I want Pat Buttet? Do I want Jerry Butler? Based on what was happening in-game and what the head-to-head matchups were with all of his players at the dot. To my knowledge, and he was, of course, Captain Video, lugged the big VCR around everywhere that he went. Wasn't the first, because the Maple Leafs did that going back to the 60s, but he was the one that popularized it. The note that I always bang when it comes to the origin of quote-unquote analytics is it depends on what you define as analytics. And if you go back to some of the earliest game sheets in the history of the NHL,
mm-hmm.
goals are marked, and that's it. But on the game sheets, some of the earliest ones, there are notes from the NHL, Frank Calder would have been the president, indicating to the official scorer, when able, indicate an assist to encourage. The idea was part of marketing, I would imagine, for the game, more points, make mm-hmm. players look better. So you could make the argument that an assist was the first analytic. A goal is the goal. That's what matters, right? Well, no, this is what led up to the goal, these assists.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always made the point that the first analytic in the NHL was assists. We've just grown up assuming that it's as legitimate as a goal, and that's the way it's always been.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't always like that.
Go back and look at those early game sheets.
Well, I think if you look back, it used to be like this. I'm not sure if it is anymore. But the first year of NHL scoring, Joe Malone, 44 goals, and they don't keep assists.
That's right.
So I could see it. It's a good point. Never would have thought about it.
All right. On that, we'll wrap up. Thanks for being patient with us last week, only the one podcast. Thanks for all the kind words about the Paul Bissonnette podcast. That was a lot of fun to be part of, and it was well received. And thanks for Biz Nasty for making himself available. Taking us out today, and a big thanks as always for our producer, ML Delich. Taking us out today, three-piece folk group from Southern Ontario. Catch them in concert May 8th at the Monarch Tavern. I love that, by the way, Amel. Monarch Tavern in Toronto, and the 9th at Artword in Hamilton. Here's Joe Bass with Part-Timer on 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
Tax man's coming down. Coming down on me. Whoa, tax man's coming down. Coming down on me. Someone tell Preacher Joe, Lord, come and save me.
That Joe's no preacher.
Bottles and sippy cups, find your heart, true love's a slut. Pay me for another day, tomorrow I promise I'll go away. I got all the time in the world, half of my time on this world, other half within the dream. It's a good thing that I can't sleep. My mama, she thinks I'm a drunk. My boss treats me just like a minor, sure that I treat you up front. Well, hello there, I'm a part-timer. 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 What do you want when you grow up? Please, ma'am, I got a degree.
Let me take your coffee, please.
I lost my job.
Jason Blood.
I work for free.
For good measure.
Life ain't cheap.
Living's crap.
Let's save it up for my
core life crisis.
Well, each day sure is a riddle. That must make me a one-liner. You can quit, get in a cell. Just for now, just part-timers.